This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. NPR's Robert Siegel will host his last edition of All Things Considered tomorrow. Siegel has been hosting the flagship news magazine program since 1987 and has been with the network for more than 40 years. Siegel announced last April that he would step down from the host chair and leave his full-time career as a journalist.
His interviews and stories in four-plus decades at NPR have covered everything from the fall of communism in Eastern Europe to The Simpsons. Before he hosts his last edition of All Things Considered, he joined us from the NPR studios. Robert Siegel, it is a true pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for inviting me, Mitch. It's my pleasure.
And are you at the point where you are thinking that, you know, this is the last time I'll see this or this is the last time I'll have to do that?
Yes, that's been happening for quite a while, and it's sort of odd. But yes, I'm thinking about last things happening these days.
Can you reflect on the kind of place NPR was when you first walked in the door?
Well, it was much smaller than it is today, and it was younger, I'd say. People often forget, we now have a beautiful headquarters in Washington, D.C., but the building that I came to in NPR, when I came to work at NPR, was two buildings ago. And the three studios that we had were, I think, the most beautiful radio studios I had ever seen. And I'd already worked in radio for 6, 7 years, something like that. It was very well equipped. It was full of lots of bearded people. it was a place where people were actually trying to put the program on the air. There was only one daily program to speak of, All Things Considered. And the idea was to put a program on the air that we would listen to, which may sound on one level self-evident, but it's kind of fighting words to an audience researcher who would tell you, well, you're not reaching the right demographic if you don't. But I think the sincerity of the place was what struck me more than anything else, and the idealism of it, that we could actually do radio journalism the way we thought it should be done, not the way we figured you have to do it in order to succeed in a tough marketplace, and that if it was the show that we would all find very interesting, there must be a few hundred thousand other people like us out there, and I think we were right.
This was 1976, I think.
End of 76, yeah.
Yeah. Did you and the others who were there, the other bearded people, see the network as the sort of place that you might go to work for 40 years at that point?
When I moved down here, I saw it as a place that was good for about 2 years is what I thought. And I thought I had left New York City when the radio station I worked at was sold. I figured it would take me a couple of years to work my way back to civilization. And my wife had been very supportive, and she and our one-year-old daughter, we only had one child then, we'd made the trek down to Washington, living in Northern Virginia. It all seemed to me to be an unfortunate detour that I would have to, I'd be able to correct for within a couple of years. I was utterly seduced by National Public Radio. We didn't shrink from spelling it out in those days. National Public Radio turned out to be a very exciting environment to work in.
Well, so flash forward a couple of years. As you look around NPR today, this is a network that is known and respected internationally. What was NPR's reputation when you became the London bureau chief?
Well, we didn't have much of a reputation. I mean, we had won awards for All Things Considered. Susan Stamberg was a great and unusual host of All Things Considered and had made a great impact on those who listened to us. It was only with the launch of Morning Edition that the audience began to multiply as rapidly as it did. When I was in London, I was based at the BBC, and there people had been working together with NPR, so they were aware of who we were and what we did. But when I spoke to ordinary people whom I would meet in London, I would have to explain to them what this thing was. And we just didn't have that that high a profile. But before I'd gone to London, most of the people we called up in the United States for interviews or for bookings of some sort or another would not know what we were exactly, unless it was in Minnesota. they had a dynamic statewide broadcast system, Minnesota Public Radio. And there, everyone from public office holders to baseball players knew what public radio was and what NPR was. But generally, we were just a little thing coming over the horizon.
So was there learning on the job you had to do as this kind of newly minted bureau chief?
I guess, but I was surrounded by 1,000 pretty smart people doing radio. In some ways better than I'd ever seen it done. In other ways, I thought it was kind of odd the way they did things. But it was a tremendous learning experience, and I learned from lots of people around me, and I learned from people whom I'd worked with at NPR in Washington. I was one of two editors after doing 6 months of newscasting, and the other was a guy named Robert Krulwich, who had actually been the friend of a friend who had connected me with NPR in the first place. And he was about the most creative character I had ever worked or have ever worked with ever since. And I learned a tremendous amount about problem solving and how do we think in terms of what kind of stories we'll do and how do we do those stories and when do we say that's not a radio story and when do we say I've got to figure out a way to make that a radio story. So I it was a great rapid learning experience for me.
You were on Fresh Air a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and you talked about your sound when you were a young reporter and anchor, that you were basically trying to sound like someone who was on the radio.
Yes.
Can you pinpoint when you went from that sound to settling into the voice that was really yourself?
I can't. However, my personal obituarist, Melissa Gray, a very gifted producer on All Things Considered, went rummaging through the archives to put a couple of things on the air about my career here. And she has a point somewhere in the late 1990s that she feels my style of speaking on the air changed around that time, which was about 10 years into hosting the program. So I had 10 years of growing up in public on the radio. But we recently replayed a story that I did about my love of a particular movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, the Allegretto, the second movement, and I think it was from 15 years ago or more, and the tracks were intercut. I did some tracks that I had to update because there were time references in the original story, but some of the voice tracks of mine were there from the original piece, And to my ear, and I can be pretty critical about hearing my own voice, they were indistinguishable. So I was sounding, I think I've sounded pretty much the same for somewhere between 15 and 20 years. And for better or worse, that's what I sound like on the radio.
Let me ask you, as a radio person for the mm-hmm. last 25 plus years who has kids, did you ever use your radio voice to annoy your kids?
I don't think I ever did that, or that they would believe me if I did. But I think you're revealing something about yourself, Mitch.
To try to wrestle this back to a somewhat serious tone.
Yes, please, of course. Yeah.
Journalism is in a somewhat different place in society now than it was in 1976 or 1986 or even 1996. What do you make of the era we're in, and does this feel like the right time to get out?
Well, it feels like the right time to get out, not because of the era we're in, but because of the era that I'm in. And that's really driven by my sense of whether I continue doing what I've been doing or do something different or do less or whatever. So it's that's not it. I'm not retiring either because of or despite the era of accusations of fake news. At the moment, It's not just that there are people who mistrust journalists. There have been lots of people who mistrust journalists for years. They have found a leader in the voice of the president, which is kind of odd, but it's a time when the president speaks frequently about how institutions that report things that he doesn't like are faking it and are in some way fraudulent or that their intent is off. And that's different and unlike anything that I can recall from my working life in Washington. But I would add that as for actions against journalists and I would say still journalism institutions, although some would say that an antitrust intervention might prove the contrary,
sure.
He hasn't done as many things to journalists as Richard Nixon did. That is, he hasn't done the equivalent of starting an FBI investigation of Dan Shore, who later became a colleague and dear friend at NPR. That's what Richard Nixon did. He didn't set out to destroy the Washington Post, as you can hear him saying in the tapes in the movie The Post that's out right now. So Nixon, who bitterly opposed the news media and journalism, actually also did things that were harmful to individuals and I would say to institutions. He smashed public television and prevented it from having a structure like ours, frankly, in radio. So at some level, we've been through worse, the media have. We also should remember that our job, although those of us in broadcasting develop some personal rapport with the people who follow us, that's different from a byline in a newspaper and people who read you, the job really isn't about being everybody's favorite media star. It's about telling people what's going on in the world and relating stories about what's new. And that can be charming, and it can be friendly, and it can also be disturbing. That comes with the territory. So I think that the challenge to all of us in the news media is to keep at what we do, to do it very well, to be mindful that there are many people who mistrust us, and to soldier on, be careful to make sure they have no real reason to mistrust us. And do the job. I think the institutions of journalism will outlast the individuals who carp about them.
As you clear off your desk for the last time, is there one most important thing that you will take off of that desk with you as you go into retirement?
I've just been doing this. I've just been clearing off my desk, and I can't tell you the array of junk that I've had on my desk all this time. It would be... it would be very trivial for me to remark on the strange wood-shaped egg cup that's been sitting on my desk for the past 10 years. I don't know why. I actually do have the coaster I've been using has been from the Milwaukee Rotarians for the past 30 years, from a luncheon that I must have spoken at sometime in the 1980s. I have no idea why it's there. My desk is a tribute to the random nature of life, that many things are accidental and purposeless.
Well, the Milwaukee Rotarians will be honored for the for the shout out, as they say.
it's been there all this time. I don't know whether to take it home with me or bequeath it to one of my colleagues.
Well, Robert Siegel, as I say, this is my 25th year in public radio.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I am sad that it took until your last week of work for me to get to speak with you. But thank you so much for everything you've done for this field and for your time today.
Mitch, thank you very much. And thanks, actually, especially to people who not only listen, but who also support their public radio station. It's a way, in part, of supporting what we do at the network at NPR News, and it's something that I think all of us who work here appreciate a great deal. So thanks to all of you.
Well, you are honestly for all of us a shining beacon of what this field can be.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you.
And best of luck to you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Robert Siegel has been the host of NPR's All Things Considered for 3 decades. His last show at the program will be tomorrow and will end his more than 40-year career at NPR. We spoke with him from NPR studios in Washington, and you can read more about his work at WUWM.com.